Six above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take it to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to play. Welcome to the Tuesday, August 16th edition of A Public Affair. I'm Patrick Barrett, and I'll be your host today, sitting in for Cynthia Lynn. Today, we're going to talk about a topic of ongoing importance, the struggle to defend the rights and living standards of Wisconsin workers. While the dramatic events at the state capitol last February and March may seem like the distant past from the vantage point of the dog days of August, the struggle at the heart of those events is no less significant today. The aim of today's show is to assess the state of Wisconsin's labor movement, focusing in particular on the challenges confronting public sector workers as they struggle to organize in the aftermath of the loss of collective bargaining rights, the political implications of last week's recall elections, and the strategies and tactics that the broader labor movement could or perhaps should adopt to contend with this new political reality. To tackle these questions, I've invited four guests who have extensive experience with the labor movement, both in Wisconsin and nationally. Joining us in the studio are Don Taylor, a labor educator and assistant professor with the University of Wisconsin School for Workers, who's also a former union organizer and has worked for several unions in both the private and public sectors. Welcome, Don.
Hi.
Mike Konopacki, a labor activist and cartoonist who, with Gary Huck, created Huck Konopacki labor cartoons in 1983. Since then, Mike and Gary have published six collections of labor cartoons, and Mike is also co-author and illustrator of Howard Zinn's graphic history, A People's History of American Empire. Welcome, Mike.
Hi, Patrick. Thank you.
Adrian Padgett. Padgett. I pronounced that correctly.
Yes, you did.
A graduate student in the sociology department at UW-Madison and a member of the Teaching Assistance Association. She served as shop steward for her department for the past four years and was recently elected to serve as one of the TAA's co-presidents. Welcome, Adrian.
Thank you for having me.
And joining us by phone from St. Louis is Jerry Tucker. Jerry's a former UAW International Executive Board member. He's also a co-founder of the Center for Labor Renewal and director of the Solidarity Education Center, and a steering committee member and co-founder of the Labor Campaign for Single-Payer Healthcare. Over the last 40 years, he's been associated with numerous well-known labor and community struggles for justice. Welcome, Jerry.
Yes, well, glad to be here.
So, as most listeners know, the passage of Walker's budget repair bill dealt a major blow to the labor movement by doing away with collective bargaining rights for the strongest sector of that movement, public sector workers. In essence, Walker set the clock back a half century by returning public sector workers to the conditions under which they were forced to organize in the first half of the 20th century. All four of our guests were recently involved in a day-long workshop on July 14th with public sector workers from the UW campus. Jerry and Don facilitated the workshop, a sort of shortened version of the Solidarity School that Jerry has organized for many years in different parts of the country. Jerry, can you tell us a bit more about that, about the concept of a Solidarity School?
Sure, Patrick. The concept is pretty old in the sense of labor. It really, in past century, it goes back to starts with the TUEL, Trade Union Education League, in the 20s. And you had other experiences like Brookwood Labor College, the Commonwealth School, and then later the Highland Center in Tennessee, which is more recent. That was where we drew our inspiration. I and a number of colleagues back in the early 90s began to experiment with having roving solidarity schools rather than fixed location schools around the country, and we've held a number of those. They tend to be four-day weekend events, which encompass a lot of progressive subject areas, but also are almost always dedicated to the development of strategies and tactics for workers who attend and for the workers that they go back to do service with. The more recent version that we put together in Wisconsin, while it was merely a one-day event, branched off of that initial concept.
So who initiated this idea? Where did this come from to do one in Wisconsin?
I think it was collectively decided by a number of people. There was a troublemaker school put on earlier during right in the midst of the heated activities of the time. There had been some discussion about the classic four-day school, being put together for the greater Wisconsin area or Madison area. But we pretty much decided that right now, in the face of the collective bargaining, the taking away of collective bargaining, we had better get started having some initial discussions. And so the decision was made there at that end about trying to pull together members of at least three locals who are all part of the university system at the University of Wisconsin there in Madison, as I think a way of beginning a process, not as a culminating event, but to begin a process. And I think that's where we're at right now.
So who more specifically participated in this particular workshop?
Well, of course, Don did the heavy lifting of facilitating from beginning to end and preparing a lot of the materials. I came in to help to assist in that regard. There were, and I don't know the number exactly, but it seemed to me about 30-some people who participated. They came from AFSCME Local 171. There were several from AFSCME Local
2412.
2412, yes. And, of course, members of the TAA unit at the university were also in attendance with Adrian. Discussion, you know, essentially started by just recognizing, and I think I made this point early on, that this is a different world, that the workers in public sector in the state of Wisconsin are now going to be experiencing. And it's unknown as to exactly what kind of relationship they're going to have with their immediate employer. It's fairly well known how negative the experience is and will continue to become as long as Governor Walker wields the axe in the way that he has over wages and benefits. And I suspect in time there'll be layoffs and other things to deal with as long as he's in the driver's seat there. So these are all the kind of issues that we anticipate. We had some discussion initially, and we anticipate seeing as a continuation.
So were there particular concerns that emerged? I mean, were there these particular unions, public sector unions on the UW campus, did they identify specific hot issues that they're most troubled by? And
I don't think we've gotten to the point of just placing the kind of campus-based or worksite-based issues on an agenda. The first phase of this, Patrick, is essentially to create a greater degree of homogeneity amongst the various locals and work groups. I mean, within each local, there are specifically the local 171, there are a number of different work sectors who do various kinds of different work, and they are not necessarily see themselves as contiguous in all cases. And so the first piece of the puzzle is to, in light of the fact that collective bargaining used to be the tie that bound, absent collective bargaining, and this is we find to be historically true, workers have to figure out other ways to band together and form, again, as I've said at that first session, you may have been being deprived of collective bargaining, but you are not deprived of having a union. The decision to have a union is the decision of the workers. No manager, no governor can decide that for you. So in this case, the question is, what kind of union? How will the union function? How will they function as members and leaders within the union? And those are the issues to be worked with.
Well, let me I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead. No, this is going to be true throughout the state. I should say that while we've looked at and are working specifically to create a model there at the university, this will be true throughout the state amongst public sector unions. They will have to figure out, without question, new ways to work with their membership, and in some cases with some particularly difficult situations with their bosses and the administrations that they work for.
Right. Well, let me ask Don to jump in here at this point and ask him, what strategies or tactics did participants focus on? I mean, did you get to that point where Jerry mentioned that is, in fact, a part of the Solidarity School model, is to focus on strategies and tactics, or is that something further down the road yet?
I would say for the most part, at least
looking at that day in a vacuum, it's something further down the road, but there have been several steps taken since then. That day was specifically focused on building the foundation of how do we build workplace power? How do we recreate workplace organizations that can move forward and tackle whatever the workplace problems are that we identify? And as Jerry said, really hammering home the idea that workers are a union because they say they are, not because they ring a magic bell and get certification from the state.
Did that message make it through? I mean, did people embrace that idea?
I think they did. Of course, changing 75 years of a particular mindset or culture isn't going to happen overnight. The 35 people that were there, I think, got it. The question is, to what extent are they going to be able to help their coworkers get it? I see our role as building that initial core of people that can then educate and move their members to action.
Right. Actually, I'm going to pick up on a point of that and come back to it in a little bit. But from what I understand, participants left the workshop pretty energized. Is that the case? I mean,
I thought so. Yeah, absolutely. It was a very high energy day.
So what are the next steps? I mean, if this is in fact seen as laying the groundwork for and it's done in stages, what's the next step?
I may defer to other people in the room on that one, simply because as soon as I did that training, I left the state for a little while, and I'm not sure what has been done since then, but I've heard of things.
So I think Adrian might have
sure.
an answer to
that. I'll have a go. So almost immediately after Jerry and Don's Solidarity School, the campus unions, as well as some of our undergraduate supporters in the Student Labor Action Coalition, as well as actually private sector union members and others, came together for a solidarity meeting to discuss how we might move forward together in this new environment. And the first meeting was essentially, though AFSCME 2412 and 171 have been having these meetings for a long time, I think that this was the first time where we all made a concerted effort to attend the meeting. And there were over 45 people there in that initial planning meeting where we, brainstormed and arrived at an idea. Again, thinking about, I think the Solidarity School has helped us all realize what common interests we share. As Jerry said earlier, I think having different work sites, different kinds of work, being divided and dispersed amongst many different locations, though we are all employees of the same employer, I think that it sometimes can be difficult to realize what we share in common, or it's not as clear to folks as it might be to some others. And so we alighted upon the fact that this coming August 25th will be the day that our benefits will go up for all.
Or the cost of them.
Correct. yeah, exactly. Don't mistake me. Yes, we're not getting more benefits. We're just having to pay more for them. But what this actually results in is anywhere from a 3% to a 13% wage cut for all public sector employees. And that's incredibly significant. And so on this Thursday, the campus unions are going to have a unity lunch, thinking of a brat line rather than a bread line, per se, from 11 to 1:30 at Library Mall. On August 25th. We're encouraging all of our members as well as our allies to come down and have a bratwurst with us. We make the university work, and I think that some folks might forget that. We're also encouraging everyone to wear black on that day because it will be a very black Thursday for a significant number of us. There will also be a march from Library Mall at 4:30 p.m., that day, August 25th, to the Capitol, where there will be a rally at 5 p.m. At the Capitol to basically convey to the legislature, as well as to the governor, as well as to the corporate powers that be, that we don't want to pay for their engineered crisis.
Right. Well, let me take a little bit of a step back and get Mike into the conversation, too. This is maybe my own personal take on this, but one of the most impressive aspects of the uprising at the Capitol back in the late winter, early spring, was the way it turned the normal or typical relationship between leaders and followers on its head. Rank-and-file activists were way out ahead of the leadership in taking an initiative, and the leadership, so-called, was racing to keep pace. Do you think that kind of relationship can be sustained? That is, will the rank-and-file continue to set the agenda, or revert to the more normal pattern of taking its cues from what's often a risk-averse union leadership?
It might be wishful thinking, but I don't really think we have a choice anymore, because the old leadership model of the service union instead of the organizing union has proven to be a disaster. And so workers have been talking about this for a long time. And actually, I worked with a small group called Labor Forward back in October to put together the Labor Notes Troublemakers School in the 1st of April. And so that we had no idea this was going to happen. And then all of a sudden we realized, wow, you know, the timing was pretty good, because we thought we'd get 100, 150 people. And I don't know, we got like 400 people or something that showed up at the Labor Temple. And I think now, I mean, it's really just plain for people to see that, you know, the old service model doesn't work. And so now, what is the organizing model? And that was part of what the Solidarity School was talking about, and Don was teaching, is that how do you take back your workplace? How do you discipline your boss? And Jerry Tucker has been a leader in those tactics, because in the private sector, he'd taught workers how to work backwards, how to work to rule. One of the greatest examples, of course, is the Staley lockout in Decatur, Illinois, where the workers realized that they controlled the workplace because they bring their own expertise to their job, and every worker always puts a little bit more into their job than they're required to. When Jerry said, okay, now we're only going to put in what the rules tell us, production dropped by 30%. And that freaked out the company, which is why they locked them out. But the idea is that workers have power. They just have to find it. They just have to realize it and learn about that.
Well, let me just ask you, building on that, is there a potential silver lining then in the loss of collective bargaining rights, in the sense that it demands a greater level of rank-and-file activism if the unions are to survive?
I would argue that that's exactly the point, because I have a friend who's been, she's a former union member. She helped form a labor union in the airline industry, and she's been representing her husband in a grievance, an age discrimination grievance, for I think it's like over 5 years. The old system of doing that stuff didn't work, and now that they have no more collective bargaining, that grievance is still sitting there rotting away in OSER and Employment Relations Commission. And so the point is that that old bureaucracy that was set up in order to for dispute resolution wasn't working before this was taken away, and it's certainly not going to work now. So we do have to come up with new ways of dealing with it.
So let me ask you nonetheless to interpret, for example, just yesterday, WEAC, the statewide teachers union, announced that it'll be laying off 40% of its staff and pointed to Walker's initiatives, if we can call them that, as the cause. Are we likely to see more of that? And if so, what will this mean for Wisconsin labor? And it means essentially reinforcing your point, doesn't it? That the traditional professional staffs of these unions are in a weaker position, and therefore all the more reason that the rank and file has to do the heavy lifting.
Well, remember, unions were illegal until 1937. So, and they existed, you know, 100 years before that. So you do come up with the ways of dealing with it, and Don probably has more insight in that than I, but you have to learn how to do that. You have to teach yourself how to operate as a union. You can't use your stewards and your officers to be your insurance company anymore. Now you have to do it yourself.
Adrian is.
I think that just going to the point about laying off staff persons, I think this is clearly a repercussion of the end of dues checkoff and fair share. And so unions who had been able to rely on paid staff to do the heavy lifting because they were generating enough revenue through dues collection to pay for folks to do it. Now is the time where folks will actually have to step up, membership will have to step up and become more involved and more engaged in the daily activities of their union. Institutional memory will no longer be held by staff persons, and that kind of structure. It will be, in order for us to be successful, regular membership are going to have to really step up and do the work.
So I see you nodding there, Don.
Absolutely. You know, I don't want to, staff people for any union have great value. And I say that having been one myself for most of my career. But the fact of the matter is that, for example, the United Auto Workers defeated General Motors, which was the largest corporation in the world at the time, with no staff, with no dues deduction. And they weren't even, quote-unquote, representing a majority of the employees. They were a minority union who sat down at Flint and defeated the largest company in the world. And the ability to do that is really what matters. I'm not saying that there should be a massive sit-down strike and that's how we're going to win anything. But the fact of the matter is that the real power of any union organization comes from the members taking power in their own workplace, shifting power from the employer to themselves. And staff can play a role in that, but it can also be done without staff. What I fear is that the model that we've created since the National Labor Relations Act has been a very staff-centered model. And we're going to see the laying off of staff now prior to our full implementation of anything new to replace it,
right?
Or anything old, to be honest, which the model is very old.
Right. Yeah. So, Jerry, I don't know if you're nodding or shaking your head because you're on the phone in St. Louis. Do you want to? We're going to take a little music break in a minute or two, but I want to give you the last word on this particular topic.
Let's pick up on this old is new again theme that just emerged, because that's essentially what has to happen. There were many workplaces in the 20s when the IWW and others were experimenting with a lot of strategies and tactics and so forth that used broke away from the machinist model, which existed at the time. The machinist had a major union and in place at that time, and they worked to the point that they scared the employers sufficiently enough that by the time the 30s and the New Deal came around, you wound up having the beginning, after Flint, of course, after Flint and Little Republic and some of the other major encounters, you had this emergence of an industrial relations model. Now, a lot of people thought that was great. That would place everything in an even plane. Quite the contrary. That actually was, in many ways, designed to keep labor peace while the employer figured out other ways to increase productivity at the expense of workers, of course, in all the ways they have. And we find ourselves burdened, I think, in large part, in the labor movement today by both that a lingering shell of that industrial relations model, which came out during that period and persisted through the 50s, 60s, but began to shred itself in the 70s and in the 80s, is virtually gone. Problem was, longtime labor leaders, conditioned as they were to be a part of that system, couldn't figure out what the new ball game was all about. And to this day, there are still people holding down rather high positions in the labor movement who are still not yet figuring it out and pretty wistful about trying to find a way to return to that now not available norm.
I just got a note that we have a caller who's got a question for us. Caller, go ahead.
Hello, yes. I am a member of ASME. I'm retired. But if I remember correctly, when I joined ASME, it was not a union, it was an association. And that the people in the association had worked hard with the legislature to be allowed to form a union. I don't believe the union was formed until sometime in the 1960s. and that I remember because I was one of the members that went down, and we could not bargain for wages and so forth. We could bargain only, I guess, grievances and a few other things. So when we're talking about the state employees union, they were around for a long time before it was actually a union, and that they were able to get many things that then the union also was able to get and get some bargaining power in. And I'll hang up and listen to your guest response.
Thanks very much. Don, I think you have an answer to that or a response?
Well, he describes it pretty accurately. Certainly in the public sector, we had employee associations that existed for decades prior to the implementation of collective bargaining in the public sector, which really came in the 1950s and 1960s. And Wisconsin was the first state actually to pass a law allowing municipal collective bargaining, and that was in 1959. AFSCME, the preeminent public sector union, was born in Madison as an association that attempted to band together public workers and work in the interests of public employees in the absence of collective bargaining. Once collective bargaining became legislated, overnight these associations de facto became unions. But whatever we call it, it's an organization of employees.
Right.
We need to stop getting hung up on names and think more about what we can do with our collective power.
Okay. We've got another caller. We're going to postpone our little musical interlude. Caller, go ahead.
Is that me?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I was an AFSCME. In fact, I was in 171 for over 30 years. I'm now retired. But if my recollection is accurate, it seems to me that the Wisconsin State Unions basically were forbidden to strike and to have binding arbitration. So, in a way, it seems if we're going to come back, maybe it'd be nice to come back as a real union with ability to strike, or at least with the binding arbitration ability. And that's basically my comment.
Adrian's nodding her head.
Sounds good to me.
All right. Okay, I think I might even make an executive decision here and postpone or scratch the song, because I think we've got enough to discuss here and make better use of the time. Let's shift a little bit. A lot of people, and let's shift our attention to the electoral arena. A lot of people have claimed that the principal motive behind the attack on collective bargaining rights was to destroy the political capacity of unions and of the progressive movement more generally by eliminating the only significant non-business source of money in the electoral arena. In fact, nationally, business outspends labor in elections by a ratio of 15 to 1 overall. In fact, it's something like 12 to 1 among Democrats and 89 to 1 among Republicans, but they're just heavily outspent across the board. And in Wisconsin, that margin's likely to increase. So shifting our attention to the electoral arena, as many people know, the recall elections that took place last Tuesday grew out of the protests at the state capitol. Unions and their allies targeted 6 Republican senators closely identified with the Walker agenda in the hopes of unseating at least 3 of them and thereby giving a majority in the Senate to the Democrats, presumably the first step toward eventually reversing the Walker agenda. But as it turned out, the Democrats succeeded in unseating 2 of the 6 and so fell short of gaining a Senate majority. And that, of course, came on the heels of another close and hard-fought election in April when Joanne Kloppenburg lost to David Prosser in the Supreme Court race by a very narrow margin. So turning first to Jerry, and, given your vantage point of not being in Wisconsin, what's your perspective on this? How should we interpret the outcome of the recalls?
Well, first, I think interpreting the recall needs a larger housing to hold it, and that is the fact that your first point was, what is the agenda of the business community and the corporate structure, especially that with vis-a-vis labor, and how does it tie the Republican Party? I don't think it's as simple as saying the Republican Party, which is the party of big business, is simply out to negate labor's role in elections and therefore push the Democrats into maybe the minority party on a perpetual basis. I think that certainly is an objective for many of them, but the corporate community has been working at this question of taking back the benefits of the great explosion of the 30s, the CIO's injection of new energy and purpose for an awfully long time. And they would seek, as they have always sought, to commodify workers and have workers available in large reserve pools to work at the lowest possible wages. And of course, globalization has added strength to their ability to wield that club. Now, so you have to combine, I think, all of those factors when you say, well, what brings this all about? I mean, I think it's a larger question, not just a matter of unions in electoral politics. On the forward side of it, though, I don't think you had any choice, by the way, in Wisconsin, with regard to the great outpouring, the upsurge that was represented, the rising there of protest, and tapping into, as has already been described, not the voices of labor leaders, but the actually much larger roar of voice and cadence of rank-and-file workers, whether they belong to unions or not. You could not have achieved all of that demonstration power there in the Capitol and in many ways across the state just by union members. I think there was a great coming together within what we would love to call the working class. And that's a very inclusive class if people think about it. That includes people who service the working class. It used to be called bourgeoisie in some cases, but like insurance salesmen, the bartender, the beautician. We used to call it the three Bs, bartender, beautician, and barber. All of these are relatively elements of the working class that we're talking about. So you had no choice but to move forward and do what you could electorally that was in front of you. Or the people who had raised their voices would have wondered about that. And I think the same is true moving forward on the recall of Governor Walker. But I also think that people cannot rely exclusively on electoral politics to resolve these questions. That's why it's equally important that workers see themselves as the leaders they've been looking for in the workplace and in their own communities specifically. I would actually, and have argued this for some time, that your state is now rife for a recapturing of something the Knights of Labor used to try to do, experimented with, called working people's assemblies. And that would involve people who are in unions and people who are not, all throughout the state, in the building of rank-and-file base movement support, whether it be in Oshkosh or up in the Green Bay area or over in La Crosse and all throughout, in small towns as well as medium-sized cities, build something out there that could be turned into a social movement, not just an electoral force, but a social movement. That will change. That accomplishing that, and that you will significantly change the direction of where your state's going to go.
Huh. I want to remind people that this is a public affair. If you'd like to join the conversation about the Wisconsin labor movement, and currently we're talking about the results of last Tuesday's recall elections. So I'm going to come back to that point that Jerry was making. But first, let me just get another opinion. Don, how do you interpret the recalls? I've seen opinions covering the entire spectrum from this was a great victory for the progressive movement to this was a major defeat. Where do you fall on that spectrum?
Well, it's hard to say where I fall. The fact that two victories for the side of labor were achieved is an important achievement. If the goal was to win back control of the Senate, then we have to be somewhat disappointed if we're on the side of labor. At the same time, though, I think Jerry raises an important point that if the Democrats had won control of the Senate, from the labor perspective, then what had we achieved if that had happened? We have achieved something electorally that perhaps staves off more bad things from happening. As Rich Trumka once said, we have to stop defining winning as not losing. And we, as a movement, have over history, at least in the 20th century and into the 21st, have often seen electing Democrats as a way to give us room to breathe and room to, you know, at least hold off the bad things until we can do something else. And we've never done the something else. If we achieve breathing space, we have to use it to organize. And we haven't done that in the past.
So, and this is open to anybody here. I mean, what are the pros and cons of elections then as a tactic? I mean, there is a strong prevailing, and I don't know if it's the prevailing opinion, but it's a growing opinion, that there's a risk in focusing so much attention on elections that it seems to be a case of putting one's eggs in a single basket. And that these recalls in the April Supreme Court race seem to provide evidence that the electoral system is a playing field in which progressives have limited, if not diminishing, prospects of prevailing. And, you know, that there seems to be some serious trade-offs. And I see Adrian nodding her head. So
yeah, nodding vigorously over here. What I would say is, in my opinion, and this is only my opinion, in February and March, the reason why people came out was not because of the Fab 14. I don't think that it was because 14 Democratic senators left in response to a GOP-dominated Senate and assembly. I think it was because they saw thousands of other people out there and finally realized after a long time period of failing to recognize that there is a variety of ways to exercise political power. And I think that focusing only on our electoral political power is a mistake. I found this is for me why the recall elections and the recall efforts are more sticky for me. I don't believe that people stayed out for those weeks, slept at the Capitol, because they ultimately thought that that was going to result in a recall. I think that I don't think that people were willing to sacrifice all of those hours simply to cast a ballot in a ballot box. I think that they had rediscovered something about exercising power collectively in a very visceral way that I think was then almost misdirected into something that was far more familiar to big labor to pull off, which is its participation in electoral politics, rather than revisiting and reconstructing, maybe from whole cloth, the way in which you need to go about organizing workplaces and organizing people and making community labor alliances that can withstand poor electoral results. I think it is also true to say, though, that, you know, with these two wins, does it bode well for the recall of Governor Walker? Should people pursue that? Yes, I think it does. Madison and Milwaukee weren't part of the overall tally. To the extent that you believe that our collective problems as working people in the state of Wisconsin can be ameliorated by the changing of the guard with a Democrat, well, then maybe that's something you want to pursue. But I would like to challenge Jerry and say I don't think the Republican Party is the only party of big business. I think the Dems very much are too.
No, I'm sorry if I.
Oh, that's okay, Jerry. Just double checking.
I'm a Labor Party advocate.
Yeah, me too. But you know, just recently today in the Times, the New York Times, they reported that public sector workers there voted to accept concessions from Governor Cuomo, a Democrat. It happened in Connecticut, too, and it could very well happen here. And so I think I take Don's words to heart when we talk about how, and Jerry's, too, about having to create something that can actively respond to whatever party might be present, particularly if they don't do what we feel is right and what is necessary.
I just want to add the example of the bluest state in the country, Massachusetts, also did a mini Wisconsin on their public workers this legislative session and took away their right to negotiate health insurance benefits.
We've got a couple of callers, but before I go to them, I asked a question earlier, and I think that it applies to the labor, quote-unquote, leadership as well, that, again, and I think this, if I'm interpreting what Adrian is saying correctly, that during the protests, again, just as with the unions, the political leadership was racing to keep pace with the grassroots. And so I guess it's a question of how can the grassroots continue to set the agenda rather than or avoid reverting to the more typical pattern of taking its cues from what really is a risk-averse professional political class, which is typically inclined to steer the political energy in a less militant direction. Go ahead, Jerry.
Petra, I'm going to just insert this and let you go forward. And that's where I pitched the concept of the Working People's Assemblies, because that's essentially what they are. They're horizontally formed organizations of working people, members of unions and people who see themselves as within the same radius of interest. And they're not formed in just with leadership speaking for them. They're actually places that meet regularly, and they are, in effect, they're better than the Tea Party on a much more progressive basis. I almost hesitate to even suggest the use of the name Tea Party as the flip out of opposite or something like that, because it doesn't really describe it. It's a way of building a mass movement, and a mass movement that will make decisions at the horizontally developed rank and file level and forward them, through the process.
I think Mike wanted to jump in here, too.
Well, I wanted to agree with Adrian when she said that it shouldn't matter who's in government. If you have a strong enough labor movement, they're going to have to pay attention to you. I mean, imagine what would happen if that $15 million that was spent on Democrats was actually used to organize unions in Wisconsin. I think people would pay attention. It wouldn't matter who was in office. You have to give credit to all the people that organized those recalls, because they were in Republican districts and they did it. I mean, they went door to door and they got people that wasn't coming out of Madison. That wasn't the people, it was probably some of the folks that were marching around the square, but those were Republican districts and they actually did that. But as Emma Goldman once said, that if the ballot was actually gave power to the working class, the ruling class would get rid of it. And now you've got Voss saying, oh, we're going to get rid of these recalls now because they you shouldn't have elections every month. But then you get into the argument of messaging, so-and-so lost because they had wrong commercial or so-and-so did this. And Howard Zinn warns us that as workers and as citizens, we're not politicians. So we don't have to state our message so that a lot of people will like what they hear. We just have to do it. And then things happen. And so you have to, so instead of sitting, who sits in the governor's chair, it should be who's sitting outside, who's sitting in the middle of a street, or who's sitting in the Capitol building. And that's the kind of pressure that we have to put on, because we have to change our whole culture now. Electoral politics isn't the solution. It's a tactic that we should utilize, but it's not the solution.
Okay. So we do have a couple of callers. We're going to go to the first one. Go ahead, caller.
Is that me?
I guess so, yes.
question has to do with what I see in terms of one of the challenges in terms of the labor movement remaking itself. Has to do with the fact that labor is now very much global. And I don't really see any way forward for the labor movement in Wisconsin and other places in the United States without some sort of real project put into place to link it to the immigrant rights struggle. And I think this is a hard thing for a lot of people to wrap their heads around who are stuck in the older ways of thinking of themselves as workers and as a working class, but I'm not sure there's any anything more promising either. So I'd like to hear your people comment on that.
Anybody want to tackle that one?
I would just say historically, as history is playing out, the caller is right. We can certainly build for and win victories at the local, state, national level right now. But in the long run and in the bigger picture, capital is now global. Business is now global. When you go back in history, when business and capital was localized, labor was localized. And as capital became a national entity, labor had to adapt. You know, the first national labor union, amazingly called the National Labor Union, was a response to the fact that capital had extended its reach throughout the country and was not just a regional power anymore. In the same way, it is hard to get our heads around, but if capital has gone global, labor has to as well, and we just haven't figured out yet what that looks like. You know, there are a lot of cross-border linkages between labor organizations and worker organizations. There are actually some efforts now to merge unions across national borders, but we're definitely just in the birthing stages.
But I think you have to give a lot of credit to immigrant workers. Like, for example, the Immigrant Workers Union in Madison mm-hmm. has started, after the 2006 demonstration, they've maintained May Day every year.
And in Milwaukee, and even on a much bigger scale.
Well, that was the most significant, because in Milwaukee, you had a May Day for, I don't know, when's the last time they had one, that you had that large of a crowd, and Trumka came and spoke. You know, so now they realize that immigrant workers are a part of the growth of the labor movement, and so
reinvigorated it in many parts.
Well, it has in Madison and other places, especially in California, and I think people are realizing that. You know, it's no longer us against them, because we're all in the same boat, and it doesn't matter. Well, you know, because capital can cross borders without any restriction whatsoever, but workers aren't allowed to. So,
and that message is also old. I mean, it's something that workers and unions have recognized for a very long time, that this is a global challenge.
Jerry,
go ahead.
That it's not just a challenge around jobs. It's a challenge because capital is constantly reorganizing itself. It's not accidental that financialization outstrips manufacturing worldwide now, as in terms of its relative sectoral power. And that places a greater burden on workers wherever they're at and their institutions in finding answers. Part of the problem in this country, and a lot of people don't want to hear this, is the labor movement has been the handmaiden of capital for all these many years, carried out in large part the U.S. government's imperial process and promotion around the globe. And it's very hard at this point for some people to step back from that and see themselves as part of a global force against capital, which they've had a more intimate relationship for an awfully long time. And I think that's all part of this process, too. It also has something to do with the relationship with the Democratic Party, I think.
Right. We have another caller, and we're going to go to that individual right now.
Yeah, hello?
Yes.
I guess my comment, first of all, I absolutely have to endorse what you're saying. The labor movement has to get out of bed with the Democratic Party, and that has to happen very quickly. In fact, I think the Democrats are more pernicious than the Republicans, because at least Republicans don't make a pretense as to what they stand for, whereas the Democrats are still trying to play this game of being all things to all people. Mm-hmm. But in effect, they're just with the tools of a certain sector of the moneyed classes in our country. Another concern I have, I'd like to see what your guests think about it. I think that the death knell of the labor movement is going to be spelled out by the situation we have now, where unions exist only in the public sector and are virtually extinct in the private sector. And I think as long as that situation prevails, I think we're going to see the death of labor unions as we know them. Also, I would like to comment. I would like to think that what you said about the need for staff, that it's not absolutely necessary, I would like to think that that's absolutely true. I don't know in reality if that's going to work now. I mean, because it's been so many generations since there was a time when unions did not have these entrenched bureaucracies. I'll just take my answers off the air. Thanks for an interesting talk.
All right. Well, you know, let me just actually throw in there on top of that, you know, some people are saying that the Verizon strike is the next major battleground nationally. And, you know, the next Wisconsin, as one article I read the last couple of days said. Do any of you agree with that? What does the Verizon strike tell us about what labor is up against at this point in time?
Well, I think the Verizon strike is very, very, I mean, exciting. It's also an incredible undertaking by members of CWA and IBEW. Members of my own union, we've already sent solidarity pizzas to those workers in Pittsburgh, New York City.
These are freshly made ones, not some
correct.
That are left over. From
correct.
The,
but as a show of solidarity, this was something that was undertaken by some of the members in my own department, in the sociology department, to respond. And there has been at least one solidarity picket or protest in front of the only Madison-based Verizon store that we were able to find. But I think that from what I've been reading, it seems as though they are positioned in a very strong place to suggest that a private corporation has made $10 billion over 4 years and now demands concessions totaling $1 billion.
So and in that those they can 4 years, they gave $250 million
right.
to their top five executives.
Exactly. Yeah. So I think that that argument cannot possibly play well amongst the public. And I think that that's what we saw in February and March, and we continue to see here in Wisconsin, that there was actually a change of perception, maybe not from those stalwarts who believe that all unions are evil, but that for those folks who had never actually formed an opinion about what unions as collective organizations can do for their members and for working people, for communities, I think that that's really it's really important. As far as the death knell of the labor movement, I really hope not. But I think that it's important that we continue and that big unions out there really consider taking some of their money and actually using it to organize people rather than to engage in other forms of resistance, again, that being electoral politics.
Don?
I would just add that, you know, we've been proclaimed dead before. I forget who it was that said in early 1929 that basically we've got the labor movement on the ropes, and I think we're within our, you know, view of a labor-free America. And then, of course, we all know what happened in the 1930s. We can't predict the future, but the fact of the matter is no matter what, workers will always organize. Will it be unions as we envision them today? I don't think so. I think the model that we've operated under since the 1930s has kind of run its course. But the I lost my train of thought. The Depression created a new landscape. And so new models don't come from academic departments and think tanks and or, you know, God forbid I say this, but from international offices of labor unions. New ideas spring forth from moments of crisis. And we're in one now, and we're going to be in one for a while. And who knows what the crisis is going to look like in 5 years. And if any type of new organization of workers is going to spring forth from the ashes of the old, I think we're well positioned for that.
Right. So, Jerry, I'm going to give you the last word because you're from St. Louis and we don't always hear you here. So what do you think the times call for now? In addition to the working people's assemblies, what should labor be where should it be focusing its efforts? What is or should be the next battlefront?
Let me quickly hit the Verizon thing as well. And I'm totally in support of a victory for the workers there, as I have been for all those other major victories like the Kennecott Copper, the Caterpillar, and Batco and all those over the years. That's the problem I have. We've built these encounters at the time as something we have to win and then find a way not to. And in the Verizon case, I think what has to be injected here, and I frankly had wished that there had been a little bit of softening up, a la workplace activities building up to the possibility of a strike. But looking at that employer, I think you have to have, we always used to argue about power at the point of production. Well, you have to, in this case, have some power at the point of consumption, because because Verizon rises or falls based on the
public
as a product. So anyway, I think the labor movement has to engage in a lot of new thinking, divorce itself from the culture that it's been mired down in for all these years. And certainly Wisconsin, to me, still is a very strong case for the laboratory for progress right now.
Well, we hope you come back to the laboratory. But I'm afraid we're out of time right now, so I want to thank Jerry from St. Louis. We're in solidarity with you, not on baseball and football, but otherwise. Adrian Pagic, Don Taylor, and Mike Konopacki, thanks to all of you for taking the time to join us, and Casey Model for engineering the show. Thanks a lot, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.